Yes, we're fast heading toward Christmas, as if you haven't noticed. And that could mean disaster. Not the family gathering type, actual disaster-type disasters. Blizzards in the Northern Hemisphere, and down here in the South, floods, bushfires, and of course cyclones.
Australian authorities have warned people to take shelter with a powerful cyclone expected to hit the northern state of Queensland shortly.
Northeast Australia bore the brunt of Mother Nature at its most spectacular as one of the most powerful cyclones in the world.
This week's Future Tense is about the ways in which we're using new technologies to respond to disaster and emergency situations. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. In one sense, it's a bit of a follow-on from last week when we spoke with Dr. Paul Gardner-Stephen about the mobile phone system he's developing for use in those sorts of situations. A system that doesn't require satellites or phone towers. If you missed that interview, you can find it on our website. Now, the internet and social media are increasingly important tools for disaster response and coordination. But they also present a challenge.
Technology, you know, it's not a thing in and of itself. It's how people interact with it. It's how people use it. You've got to know it's there. You've got to know what's happening to make proper use of it. It's affected by your context. It depends on whether you're a Westerner who's comfortable with it or a Westerner who's not, or a local from Haiti who uses a text message, a phone for text messaging or whatever. That depends on your access and what you can make use of something for. But really, we were driven by this issue about in emergencies, you've got this massive information overload that's only getting worse. And so new technologies are wonderful, but they can also contribute to part of the problem.
Nigel Snowd, a former senior advisor to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. And he was one of the authors of a report aimed at finding ways to streamline the use of social media in emergency and disaster situations. The catalyst for the report was the 2010 earthquake in Haiti.
In Haiti, there was certainly cell connection back pretty quickly after the earthquake, but it was rather spotty. I mean, it could take some time for a text message to get through. You might have to try several times to get a phone call through, sometimes sort of hours and hours would wait. And clearly it got better over time, and the same was true after the tsunami in Indonesia in Aceh when I was there after that earthquake. But we take this for granted, but it's not always there. So we do have to be a little bit careful about these technology and communications-driven services.
Now, we'll get to the recommendations from the report in just a second, but it seems to me that a lot of what the report talks about and deals with is the relationship between the technology sector or technology enthusiasts on the ground and emergency workers, the humanitarian community, as well as the people who are the victims of a disaster.
Absolutely, that's very true. Ultimately, the trust that we have in each other, if we have connections and contacts and relationships and so forth, is part of the network that we use to respond to any emergency. If you're in a local community or if you're in a international responders coming in, as some of us were. And so those relationships are really how we build the bridges. I asked this volunteer community out there to map a number of hospital locations that we couldn't quite figure out based on addresses, and they're able to do that quite effectively, and that's based on trust and relationships. And you're dead right that it's about the relationships to people on the ground as well. And this is something where I think a lot of us look at, both in the report, but particularly in other work, is look at these technologies as a potential enabler for people affected by humanitarian emergencies to have a voice. It's not the only way we can do this, but it's certainly a new channel that we want to figure out and tap.
And focusing on the positives, I mean, what are some of the technologies, the specific technologies, that are showing real potential?
One of the ones that I'm really interested and excited by the potential for is really the ability to have a lot of volunteers and people contribute to fairly mundane and menial tasks, people who aren't in an emergency zone. So one of these things might be translating messages or combing through a number of media reports to extract salient bits of information. And I find it quite amazing that we can divide this task up amongst lots of different volunteers or amongst our own staff at the United Nations in different agencies who aren't in the zone, and ask them to really help us make sense of the situation in a way that we can't there on the ground. And this is a possibility, you know, for local organisations. It's a possibility to engage the global community And in Haiti, we saw that it was a chance for the diaspora, the Haitians who weren't living there anymore, to actually contribute in a way to the emergency response in their country. And I found that incredibly empowering in a way.
What about the pressures on those involved with the technology, those who are trying to help by rolling out technological fixes, if you like? In a situation like Haiti, what sort of pressure did they come under to actually provide more help to communities?
Some of the newer groups particularly were just caught up in the rush that happens in an emergency response. If you're on the field, in the ground, or if you're caught up in an affected community, it is all hands on deck all the time. And I think that caught some people unawares about the level of both adrenaline and engagement, enthusiasm, and just having to channel your energy over and over again day after day. And they were certainly trying to figure out how to be sustainable. And it's really the big question for us. It's one of the ones we raise in the report, is the professional humanitarian community, if you like. One of the things we struggle with is how do we make sure that we can respond when required and where needed and sustain that over time. And it's one of the big questions for the volunteer communities and the new technology communities is how do you transition that to something that continues, that adds lasting benefit and so forth.
And now just briefly, the report made what are called 5 framework recommendations. Could I get you to take us through those?
Yep. One of the recommendations was that we really do need a neutral space whereby these different communities can come together. This would be the traditional humanitarian community, the UNICEFs and the United Nations of this world, and these volunteer groups, some of which are very loosely organized, some of which are technology companies, can come together to have a discussion around the kind of things we're talking about. And one of the reasons we started the report was to kickstart that process. It's important that we have this space where we can have these conversations about these issues of standards, of consequences, of reliability and so forth. That's probably a couple of the recommendations I've wrapped up there. Another one was that we really struggle for the need for innovation labs, if you like. For the humanitarian community, it's not very easy to innovate, to try new things. And one of the things that the response to Haiti and afterwards has shown us again and again is that this volunteer and technology community is racing ahead far quicker than the humanitarian community can chase. So we need a better space and a better method for innovating, trying new things and incorporating that into our practice. Another one was we really need to start addressing these issues of what is the interface between the two communities during a crisis. And another piece was that there does need to be, and this is part of moving ahead, that the volunteer and technical community needs to get better organized for providing a consistent response. There are a couple of great initiatives on this. So the Humanitarian OpenStreetMaps team, which has people from all around the world, the Standby Task Force Crisis Mappers who worked on the Libya response, helping us map that. And there's a number of other groups here that are doing that. And putting that lot together is really the core of the recommendations, I'd say.
Nigel Snowd, Senior Advisor to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. We'll put a link on our website to those 5 recommendations, and thank you very much for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
Back to Australia now, and let's tease out some of the issues that have come to the fore in recent times in this country around the use and potential of social media and other technologies in times of crisis. Maurits van der Vloo is the co-founder of an organisation called Bushfire Connect, a free community-driven service combining fire information from a variety of sources, both official and unofficial. And Lou Short is the group manager, Community Resilience, at the New South Wales Rural Fire Service. Let's hear from Maurits first about the issue of reliability. When it comes to the sorts of information spread on social networks during a crisis, is verification a problem?
It is, and it is a concern that's often heard. I'm not sure the concern is as big as some people would like us to think it is. Nevertheless, it's real. In the case of our initiative, Bushfire Connect, therefore, we moderate all reports before they are passed on, and in that aspect, it is no different than the moderation of 000 calls, for instance.
But that might be true of Bushfire Connect. That's not necessarily going to be true of all social networks operating in an emergency situation, is it?
That is correct. So there is an issue there. What we find, however, lots of studies have shown that social networks are very, very strong at self-correcting, and if people spread rumours and misconceptions, then they tend to get corrected by people who have local knowledge and maybe on the ground and corrected. Furthermore, what we saw around the Queensland floods and Cyclone Yasi is that agencies like Queensland Police actually set up little what they call myth-buster groups. So there's people from the agency who monitor what's happening on the social media, and when they see something that is incorrect, they correct it there and then.
So bad information can get out, but it won't be there for very long, is what you're saying.
That's correct.
Lou Short, is that your experience working for the New South Wales Rural Fire Service?
It is. The verification is going to be a very big challenge for the emergency sector over the next few years, I would think. There's a huge amount of information out there. And when you consider an emergency service is a very traditional command and control structure, so information comes in, moves up through the line to an incident controller and then gets approved. Social media is actually pulling that down to, you know, the lowest common denominator of someone is posting information and it's out there for everyone to see. So one of the difficulties is the sheer volume of information. You know, it depends on how many fires or what the incident may be. So it's going to be quite a big challenge for fire agencies to actually keep a bit of a tab on it.
I presume the bigger the event, the more important the event, the more information that is going to be out there that you'll have to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. And the challenge will be when we have really big years, like if we go back 2002, 2003, where we had 151 consecutive days of fire in New South Wales and huge numbers of fires and huge amounts of telephone calls and data out there, just trying to actually have people there 24/7 over that 151 day period to be able to receive information, vet it and then put it out again is going to be quite a significant challenge for us.
What's the main positive for an organisation like yours in linking in and forming, I guess, relationships with these volunteer communities?
Oh, look, I think it's just getting access to information from completely different sources. So rather than information coming through from crews on fire grounds or something like that, we're getting information from the community who essentially are now our first responders.
Moritz, I imagine that some people who are in social networks, volunteer communities, want to take part in an emergency situation, but do they necessarily want to fall under a command structure, if you like, even if it's a loose command structure?
I think they don't want that at all. That is for two reasons, primarily because they grow out of the community, mushroom up, if you like, and flourish that way. I think it's also something that we should try and avoid, actually, because by the sheer nature of it not being under a command control structure, these communities can be a lot more nimble, responsive, share information in real time in that separate ecosystem, which is separate from the command and control culture in the agencies. Therein, I think, lies the strength, and that makes these two information ecosystems complementary.
But agencies do like to take control, don't they? And particularly, you know, services like police, like fire, those sorts of services.
And so they should. So the challenge for them is that the advent of social media and social networking is that the agencies are no longer in a position to control all information flows. So the change that the agencies need to become aware of and adapt to is that they cannot control the information anymore, but they can monitor and influence it.
Lou Short, how difficult is it for some agencies to get their heads around that?
I think it's something that the agencies have come to grips with. Really, the Queensland floods were a great example of the benefits of social media. And it was a really great test case for us all to look at it and say, wow, you know, well, that is something that has worked really effectively in Queensland. And I think also that really within different social networks, social communities, there are accepted norms of behaviour as well. So it's not necessarily, the agencies have to get in and control what is going on, because quite often if you actually step back a little bit, things will moderate and people will get in and moderate it itself. So I think part of the challenge is for agencies to actually step back a little bit.
Of course, not everyone's part of an online community, are they? I presume it's still a matter of trying to marry in effective social media communication with your traditional communication. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. And social media is just, I'd hate to say, but it's just another tool in the toolbox. You know, we've got traditional media, we've got very extensive campaigns through traditional print media, advertising, radio. We do a huge amount at a local level through our districts and brigades, and we've got over 69,000 volunteers across the state, and, you know, every time they go out in the truck or they're engaging with their community, they are educating, they're building their resilience, they're forming those really amazing relationships where during emergencies we can go out and, I suppose, exchange information with them.
Moritz van der Vloo from Bushfire Connect. Many of the volunteer technical services are run by dedicated and very passionate people, but in a long-running emergency, is it hard for some of those groups to sustain some of their platforms and the service that they provide?
It is. The sustainability of a platform such as Bushfire Connect or others like that is challenging when you run it solely on a volunteer basis. People do need to eventually feed themselves and may have full-time jobs and can make themselves available through the night and weekends and things like that for a limited time. We therefore, as Bushfire Connect, have a business plan that involves getting grant funding from state and federal governments so that we can get a skeleton staff full-time.
Now, there was a meeting in Sydney recently where there was discussion between some of the volunteer and technical groups and also representatives from various agencies. What was the outcome from those discussions?
The takeaway I got from that was that compared to 12 months ago, the awareness and take-up of social media as a genuine, mature tool, information sharing tool, has grown incredibly, both in the agencies and outside of that. And we're seeing more and more successful examples. Queensland Police has been mentioned before. Green Cross Australia are working on great initiatives like that. So it's a train that has left the station, is gathering speed, and it's really the last chance to get on board.
You're with Future Tense, available as a podcast via iTunes or ABC Online, or more conventionally, across the airwaves on ABC Radio National and Radio Australia.
As we provide more information, as forecasting on events get better, people also expect they're going to have that information in a much more timely fashion, much more detailed and quite specific about what they should be doing and when they need to go or stay or move, whatever the particular event or crisis is.
Campbell Darby is the head of Emergency Management Australia, the federal coordination agency based in the Attorney General's Department. He says the high expectations many people now have of getting information in a crisis needs to be kept in check.
We work closely with all the state and territory emergency service agencies who are the ones responsible for providing that information. And they tell me, and I'm aware that it is becoming increasingly difficult, that the expectations are making life a little bit challenging for them in how they get that information out there. We have brought on a range of new warning systems. For example, the emergency alert telephone-based one is actually a very good system. But it's not the silver bullet. It won't necessarily get to everybody. There will be some people who won't necessarily get that information for a whole range of reasons. So people need to understand what their best way of getting information is.
Given the heightened expectations people have about information, is there an issue about self-reliance? Are we actually becoming less self-reliant in disaster situations?
I think that is the danger. We need to be very, very careful that we're actually putting out messages here where people need to think about their own situation all the time. They can't just rely on getting messages. Sure, the states and territories and the responsible agencies will push out as much information as they can, but people need to understand what particular risks they face and actually understand what they're going to do at a particular time, because there will be times when they won't get that information. If they're reliant on looking at web pages, what happens when the power goes down? If they're reliant on the ABC radio, what happens if for some reason that radio goes off air at the moment critique? So they need to have a good understanding of what they would do.
So in a sense, by trying to help people by giving out more information, there's also the possibility that you take away their initiative.
That could be a danger and could be a risk, but all states and territories really are working hard on different campaigns to get the right sort of information to the public, to say, here are the things you need to do to look after your own welfare, and not necessarily relying on us telling you what to do. It's actually putting it back to the individual to say, think about your situation, have in mind what you're going to do well in advance, and then make that decision.
Campbell Darby from Emergency Management Australia. Earlier this year, the federal government and the various territory and state governments adopted what's called the National Disaster Resilience Strategy, which Mr. Darby concedes will take some time to get long-term traction. His words, not mine. The idea behind the strategy is to provide businesses, communities, and relevant government authorities with better guidance about future disaster threats and about what strategies and systems have been shown to work or not work. Meanwhile, at RMIT University in Melbourne, Professor John Hanmer, who's with the Centre for Risk and Community Safety, has been researching the role the emergency management sector plays in relation to climate change adaptation. because, as he points out, climate change will be a major cause of future disasters, and emergency service workers, many of them volunteers, will find themselves in the front line. John Hanmer.
There's a lot more recognition in government of this linkage between emergency management and adaptation. But one of the reasons it's been a bit slow might be that in Australia, when it comes to, if you like, normal events, normal extremes, normal heat waves, fires, floods, we deal with them quite well. And so maybe because of that, they're almost routine. And so that sector, it is perhaps a bit siloed. People leave it to the fire and emergency managers. They're going to deal with that. And so it's not really mainstreamed into climate change thinking.
But things are changing.
Yes, definitely. It is starting to be mainstreamed because, I'll just give a couple of examples, the new National Resilience Strategy is imbued, if you like, with emergency management thinking. It's in there. It's really seriously informed the development of that strategy. There's a National Climate Adaptation Strategy as well of about a year ago, and that talks a lot about emergency management issues. But it's important to understand that those national strategies may have very little input from the actual agencies involved with implementing them.
Why is that?
A couple of reasons. They're developed by national committees, and the representatives on those committees might be the people that actually develop the strategies. And so there's a gap. It's inevitable in the institutional arrangements that there's some distance between people who sit on national committees and the actual agencies or people who do the action on the ground.
Because they're much more locally based, locally
That's right.
focused.
They're local, and in many cases, in many states, the prime responsibility tends to devolve down to local government-run groups.
Is there a sense in which, because a lot of our emergency work in that regard has been done by volunteers, that actually acts against the service in terms of recognition?
It may do, but the large volunteer groups, especially the fire agencies and the SESs, have very significant and large memberships, and so they can act, their representatives, their leaders can use that politically, I think. So they're not marginal organisations in the sense that you're suggesting. They definitely have political clout, but the political clout may not be in climate change. In the organisations, there'd be a lot of different views about climate change, whether it even exists, let alone what we should be doing about it. And that's part of the Australian scene. We don't really have clear consensus or agreement on these things.
And yet, if the predictions about climate change are right, they are the people who will be enormously important in terms of that initial emergency response.
That's absolutely right. Maybe it's a bit broader than that. Emergency Management Australia, according to the Emergency Management Australia Agency's guidelines, is conceptualised very broadly to include prevention right through to recovery. And so if we look at that very broadly, it involves a lot more than just the response on the day. It's also about what we can do, or should be about what we can do, to avoid getting ourselves into these predicaments in the first place.
We've heard about other sectors going through a period where they're losing volunteers. Is that an issue? Is there an attrition issue with emergency management?
There's a school of thinking that it is a major issue, that emergency services are struggling to find and retain volunteers. There's a couple of responses to that which I think are important to note. First of all, most emergency services have very few female volunteers. So some people have argued, well, yes, but they're only tapping half the potential market for volunteers. So that's we could have some big changes there, I think. The other thing is the emergency service volunteer groups, to some extent, reflect the communities they're from. So in many rural areas, there are very few young people because they've left the area. So those remaining take up the volunteer positions, and they're much older, of course. Around urban interface areas, we've noticed that you get a much bigger, better mix, if you like, demographically or age-wise, in terms of who the volunteers are. This is in fire and emergency management services. So it's quite patchy, and in those areas, there tends to not be such a problem with maintaining volunteer numbers, because the young people are definitely joining in. But in some areas, that does seem to be an issue.
Professor John Hanmer. Now let me tell you about GameSave. GameSave was a 5-week international competition run by the game review and news website Gameranks in partnership with the wonderfully named group Geeks Without Bounds, in which teams competed to build a working concept for an online game that addressed disaster mitigation. Annie Wright explains its inspiration.
It started with an article written about a keynote speech given by Dr. Jane McGonigal at PAX East, which is a fan convention for games. And it was talking about the idea of using games for social good and to solve problems. Like, there's a game that has the players coming up with gene allele combinations and then another one to help fold proteins, but we had never seen it used for disaster relief, which honestly seemed like a pretty intuitive pairing, especially given the developments recently, specifically regarding crisis mapping, which is sort of an emerging concept in disaster relief. That was our inspiration, and the main problem there is that crisis mapping still involves having data that is parsed by live volunteers, and that's a very stressful situation that leads to a lot of burnout. So we thought if we were maybe able to make some kind of game interface for it, it would make the learning process easier.
So GameSave is, in a sense, a metagame. It's a game designed to find a better game. And teams from across the world competed to come up with something that would be useful as well as engaging. Using game dynamics for a good cause, for more than just play, is a phenomenon we've covered on the program in the past. It isn't everybody's cup of tea. And in the case of GameSave, it certainly wasn't meant to trivialise disaster situations, according to Annie Wright. What they were looking for was a game that could aid emergency workers in the same way, I guess, as a flight simulator helps train pilots. Now, it was an experiment, and they say they're planning to follow through. But Annie Wright freely admits it was a bit more difficult than they expected.
The very first day that we sort of came up with this idea, it was all, you know, yeah, this is awesome. And then the more that we worked on it and the more that we accomplished, the more we realized how nebulous a problem it is to tackle something with an emerging concept in education, as well as something as difficult to understand and to do well as disaster management. It is a very, very demanding skill set. And it's a bunch of necessary cognitive processes that don't usually want to work together in our brains most of the time.
Now, you had various teams taking on the Game Save Challenge. Have you got a winner?
We do have a winner. His name is Paul Cole, and he is originally from New Zealand, but is working out of Sao Paulo, Brazil. And Paul's concept, which actually has a playable demo that you can find on his website, paulcole.org, is a cert sim, which is the certified emergency response team skill set. You can test your knowledge of the best response to various disaster situations. And so he's got a couple of different simulations to choose from. There's an earthquake scenario, a flood scenario, and basically it's designed to test the know-how of your reaction to a couple different aspects of disasters. Medical operations, search and rescue, hazmat stuff, fire suppression, just to name a few.
And was the overall aim of GameSave to come up with a game that could be used more for training than for in-the-field usage, or a combination of both?
You know, we didn't really specify that as a limit, because it seemed like we would maybe have better results if we didn't provide such a strong structure. Now, a lot of the initial response we got was exactly that question. So perhaps for future rounds, we will try to make it more specific. I imagine there will be a lot of meeting with more emergency management personnel to try to determine what they think would be the best investment of time, because the different audiences for each game, whether it's just general awareness for a population, like these are some guidelines, this is what you need to do in this situation, or a more specific training of skilled volunteers, or even a training tool that is designed for professionals to teach other professionals, we will probably try to make it more specific in the future as far as aims go.
Annie Wright, one of those involved in the GameSave project, speaking to me there via Skype.